हरि
ओम सहना भवतु सहना भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै
चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवसनि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम हरे राम 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 हरे हरे
Page 40. The smiling face of the Lord is the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. There are many upstarts who at once try to begin with the 10th canto, and especially with the 5 chapters which delineate the Rasa Lila of the Lord. This is certainly improper. By such improper study or hearing of Bhagavatam, the material opportunists have played havoc by indulgence in sex life in the name of Srimad Bhagavatam. This vilification of Bhagavatam is rendered by the acts of the so-called devotees. One should be free from all kinds of sex desire before he tries to make a show of recital of Bhagavatam. Sri Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur clearly defines the import of purification as cessation from sex indulgence. He says, yata yata dis cha shudyati vishaya lampatyam tyajati tata tata dharayed iti chita shuddhi taratam yenaiva dhyana taratam yam uktam. As one gets free from the intoxication of sex indulgence by purification of intelligence, one should step forward for the next meditation, or in other words, the progress of meditation on the different limbs of the transcendental body of the Lord should be enhanced in proportion to the progress of purification of the heart. The conclusion is that those who are still entrapped by sex indulgence should never progress to meditation above the feet of the Lord. Therefore, recital of Srimad Bhagavatam by them should be restricted to the first and second cantos of the great literature. One must complete the purificatory process by assimilating the contents of the first 9 cantos. Then one should be admitted into the realm of the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Yeah, because this cause, as I mentioned here, causes the bewilderment. It means when we're overly attracted by the material energy and making an endeavor to be involved in the material energy, then we get bewildered, right? This mode of ignorance. So that covering of ignorance, then we're unable to see things as they are. So this is all coming in the context of the meditation upon the form of the Lord and of the universal form. That one is making a progress in thinking of the Lord, right? Starting from the feet, moving up like this. And so then, in that process, if we are, hear me saying, the idea is to focus everything on the Lord, right? The material energy then is something that we're seeing separate from the Lord. That's why it's called material energy. Otherwise, we just call it external energy or inferior energy. So then, but because we are not seeing everything in connection with the Lord, then that meditation on the Lord is the focus. Right? So either that one's taking the material elements of distraction, connecting those to the Lord, or one is simply just meditating upon the Lord. Right? Either way. Because for the impersonalists, they're not used to the form, so therefore this is a way they can get used to it. But for the devotees, then that's not a problem. But still, the principle is that one is being careful on that one is focusing on those aspects of the philosophy that one has developed up to. Right? If one hasn't developed up to that particular level, then one is very careful. So 10th canto is basically to be restricted unless one has come to this basically purified platform. And he mentions purified specifically meaning freedom from sex desire. Right? And so that means sex desire and everything that's connected to it, gross and subtle. Right? We generally just take it as the gross aspect, but it's all the subtle, distinction, adoration, and profit. That's the whole point. So then, yes.
So that means that until you're liberated, you don't move beyond the feet?
No, no. It's as that is reduced, then you start to move up. The idea is that one doesn't focus just on the 10th canto, or so deeply on the 10th canto, until one has crossed the other 9 cantos. That's the point. So Prabhupada, in giving the 10th canto, the Krishna book, he's written the other 9 cantos in. He's done it in such a smooth way that we don't even notice it. We just think it's the stories of the 10th canto. It's so nicely done. Right? But this is the point, is one should be very careful about that. Otherwise, then the Bhagavatam itself is not dealt with properly, as seen by these so-called devotees. Right? So, yes.
Studying the first 9 cantos develops in a devotee this loving feeling of loving devotion to the Lord, and then by having that, one can truly appreciate the loving exchanges between gopis and Krishna and others.
Yes. Okay, verses 15 to 21. Immediate process of becoming liberated at the time of death. In his Priti Sandarbha, Anucheda 3, Srila Jiva Goswami explains that verses 15 to 21 describe the immediate process of becoming liberated at the time of death, and verses 22 to 30 describe the gradual process. Srila Sukadeva Goswami continues, if a yogi wishes to voluntarily leave his body, he should sit comfortably and follow the following process. Though through meditation he should merge his mind by his unalloyed intelligence into himself, the living entity, and then merge the living entity into the super-self. And by doing this, the living entity becomes situated in the supreme stage of satisfaction. Footnote 9. The Lord states in Bhagavad Gita 6:20-23, in the stage of perfection called trance or samadhi, one's mind is completely restrained from material mental activities by practice of yoga. This perfection is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind and to relish and rejoice in the self. In that joyous state, one is situated in boundless transcendental happiness, realized through transcendental senses. Established thus, one never departs from the truth, and upon gaining this, he thinks there's no greater gain. Being situated in such a position, one is never shaken, even in the midst of greatest difficulty. This, indeed, is actually freedom from miseries arising from material contact. So, the mind being merged into the self means that it's not engaged in material activities. The mind is only focused on transcendence. So, because so by nature, there's spiritual mind, spiritual senses, spiritual intelligence, spiritual identity. But the difficulty is we've engaged all that propensity in the material world in trying to become, how you say, trying to enjoy the Lord's energy separately, right? This is the difficulty, right? So that now here we're talking about those are all merged back into the transcendental position, in the transcendental self. Yes?
Yes.
He thus ceases all other activities. This stage is transcendental. It is called Labdho Kashanti. This state is actually the spiritual world, but indirectly it is described as a state unaffected by time, goodness, passion, ignorance, false ego, the material causal ocean, or material nature, 15 through 17. Does that make sense? So you're actually dealing with the spiritual world, but it's only described from these elements of basically the generic description of transcendence that's appreciated by the kind of intellectual or yogic class. Does that make sense? It's just, in other words, you describe those aspects they would prefer. Right? It's another thing, but it's actually that. You know, it's just like, let's say, you have a Ferrari and you're talking about the safety features or, you know, how eco it is or how, you know, economical it is on petrol. You understand? So that's the whole thing. It's for a particular class that you might describe it that way, but in reality, it has a whole different description because it's about the Lord and the devotees and the relations that go on there. That's the point. But here, it's only describing the spiritual world, but just indirectly, unaffected by time. There's no goodness, passion, ignorance, false ego, the causal ocean, material nature. And then you think, great, that means we're out of here. But you haven't really caught that. No, it's being out of here is not the special. It's being into there.
Is it the same kind of thing we're doing when we're connecting to the Vidarat Rupa?
Yes, it's basically the same kind of thing. In other words, we're looking at it from the perspective of our material position, that there's an anxiety we're trying to get rid of, right? Because material happiness is getting rid of a disturbance, right? So then this is the fun part. And then we complain that there's disturbances.
Yes.
The material happiness is based purely on removing a disturbance. There is no positive happiness here. Yes. Spiritual world is positive happiness, but that's a different concept. One has to realize that. Right? So it's not necessarily going to be inspirational from the beginning. It's mentioned, of course. And we can catch that idyllic aspect. But what we relate to is that it's not a disturbance for the disturbance of the material world. So getting rid of that, then we say, oh, now this is happy. I've gotten rid of, you know, time, goodness, passion, ignorance, false ego, the material causal ocean, material nature. Therefore, I will be happy. I'm projecting. Right? Like if I don't have money now, but if I get money, then I'll be happy. Or if I have a house, I'll be happy. Or a car or a position, I'll be happy. We're only projecting because we're working on the principle removing a pain produces happiness, right? Yes. But real happiness is actually connected with the relationship with the Lord. So you're basically doing both. You're connecting with the Lord, but you're looking at it from the point of, I have this disturbance, I connect it to the Lord, then it becomes purified or it goes away.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Right? So that's why much of these spiritual topics are presented from this one angle. But at the same time as then having appreciated that, then it's presented from the other angle. The Sarvadharma and Parityaja means giving up all these kind of perspectives. You just surrender to Krishna. It's just about Krishna, the relationship with Krishna. Because right? Otherwise then we're looking at, oh, if I do this, I'll get purified, or we get rid of our karma, or these different things like that. Rather than, I'm developing my relationship with Krishna, my affection for Krishna. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Yes?
So in our preaching, what technique should we use, direct or indirect?
You use both. Because then you catch all sides. You show that there's something, because otherwise if you only use the direct, they'll think it's impractical. So there has to be some indirect, so that it's, yes, now this has substance to it. We're getting rid of the difficulties in the material world. That's substance. Now developing that, you know, affections in the spiritual world, that's idyllic. Right? So as time goes, then there's more focus on the, you know, the transcendental means the idyllic aspects and less on these so-called material practical. You know, so you use, and you see what's there. People are more pessimistic, you use more of the indirect. The more idealistic, you can use more of the direct. You know, or if they're just, you know, logical balance, then you point out both. You know, this will be removed, but that's not the real thing, it's the others. Then they'll understand that. You know.
Yes.
In other words, it's encouraging persons to aspire for liberation by pointing out the negative side, whereas there's a positive. Is the negative and there's the positive.
Yes. But it's for us, it's not liberation from the material world as such. It's being it's situated in the Lord's service, but the two go together. So you mention the one, but the consciousness is not on that. So it has a different effect. You know, it's just like, let's say, you're talking to somebody, you have a purpose you're trying to get to, but you're using different words. So you're using different words because of the particular situation or position or relationship, but you have another goal that you're trying to get to. So it can be understood that you're using this dual thing, but at the same time it's effective. You know, it works.
Whereas devotional service includes the...
Yes. So the point is as soon as they're comfortable with the concept of devotional service, you just deal with that. You only have to deal with these other aspects. If they're not so comfortable with that, they're more comfortable with the idea of being freed from material miseries. Like that. But that's the nice thing about our philosophy. Devotional service already includes that, so we can describe the side effects of devotional service and their pleas. We don't actually describe liberation. We're describing the side effects of devotional service, right? So it's the same thing, but the perspective is very different. This is why we always warn about this aspect of this so-called soft preaching, is that much of the time is we're not actually describing devotional service. But devotional service already including everything, you're describing devotional service, you're just using the wording that others would appreciate. Yes.
What about railing against the machine? You know, just thrashing the material.
No, but I'm saying, what's the point?
You're saying soft preaching.
No, but I'm just saying is, do you understand the point before we get into just throwing out an opposite? See, it takes intelligence to find a loophole. But just because one finds a loophole doesn't mean one's trying to understand. So that's not actually what the intelligence we're looking for. You understand? If you understand what we're talking about.
Right,
so the thing is if soft doesn't work, why would this railing work? Preaching works. Mm-hmm. Hard preaching and soft preaching are duality. They're mundane concepts.
So when you say preaching, what do you mean?
Soft preaching means going in and just talking about this and doing some yoga or this and that and not really getting around to actually transcendence. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you've been doing programs at a yoga studio for the last, 6 months and still no one's chanting.
Right, I've seen that.
That's what we're talking about. Yeah, but this is supposed to be the new thing, and this is the real thing because the hard. But hard preaching is also wrong. The point is you're presenting Vedanta philosophy to the particular audience in words and examples they can appreciate. Because Vedanta is universal. Devotees think it's cliquish or cultish. That's a misconception. Vedanta is universal. Everything else is cliquish and cultish. You know, deal in the yogi studio. How many people are in the yoga studio?
It's a big movement.
It's a big movement, but how many, hundreds of thousands? We're talking about 7 billion people on the planet. Mm. You know what I'm saying? It's a particular class that of people who basically had a general, generic Western education, are situated kind of in the middle class kind of thing, or at least values. And then they've kind of caught on yoga's kind of cool.
They're open to kirtan.
That is there.
Right.
But the thing is they're open to anybody's kirtan.
Correct.
You know what I'm saying? And the point is why are they open to kirtan? Because we've been preaching kirtan? We're the ones who don't go out on the street and dhotis, don't do Hari Nam out on the street, don't mention the word Hare Krishna, though people don't have a problem with it. I've been told, you probably don't mention this. It's kind of like people don't care. So that means we do not get the credit that the yoga circuit is interested in kirtan. We do not get the credit. We can take advantage of it, but we don't get the credit. Why? Because we're so busy shooting ourselves in the foot.
That's correct.
Okay. So now, for the point of discussion, if you want to bring things to this emotional platform and then there's a satisfaction, this is the wrong forum. Because we can do it, but then the problem is it might go beyond what you are appreciating. Therefore, understand the point, then come to the thing of taking the thing is, okay, so that's there. So what is the weakness there? So does this other aspect have a weakness? You know what I'm saying? It's just, in other words, see the generic thing. Because otherwise this loophole finding thing, that is, it's basically, it's very Anglo-Saxon. I mean, just like so Anglo-Saxon. You know what I'm saying? It's just as soon as you say this, no, but what about that? Even though they don't even know what you're talking about, just they're intelligent enough to connect the dots and, okay, you said this and this is opposite, so that contradicts, so therefore we have a problem here. You know what I'm saying? It's useful in as an overall. In other words, that question coming up is fine as long as that foundational thing is, the topic is actually understood. Then it becomes useful, because then you're discovering all the various aspects of the topic. But as a method, it's pretty useless. That's why in most of these Anglo-Saxon kind of environments, you can't actually have a very deep philosophical discussion, because that's all that happens. There's no thought of understanding. It's a matter of finding loopholes and all that kind of thing.
Counterpoints.
It's just, yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
It's all. And so that's not a conversation.
Right. That's just a debate.
Yeah. And it's not...
It's
rhetoric. That's all. It's not logic.
Right.
Yes?
This person that it described as a soul?
He's describing the quick path, but according to slow vocabulary. See, this is what this is the real soft preaching. It's just preaching. This comment is soft, it means it's only on that side. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? You know, so that's the whole thing. It's like Indians in the West, they will not tie their hair because it's Indian. Even though probably 1 in 3 girls on the street of Westerners have their hair tied. Indians will not do it, even in the situation that Westerners would always 100% tie their hair. They won't, because, oh, then we'll be Indian. So that's what I'm talking about. When devotees get into that kind of preaching, we won't mention things that people don't actually have a problem with. Because we project, oh, but then they may think we're Hare. So what, they think we're Hare Krishnas? You know, the priest is walking down the street, you know, in that whole thing like that. The nuns are out in their habit. Do they care? No. Do the Buddhists care? No, nobody cares. You know what I'm saying? So, therefore, we see here the example of the acharyas. They're presenting pure devotional service, but the wording that they use is according to the particular audience, because there is nothing else other than devotional service. That there is the idea that all devotional service is an alternative kind of viewpoint. That's an illusion. You know what I'm saying? So, we want to be careful as devotees, we don't think like that. You know, so that comes up, is that they think, it's okay, I could present like that, that would be normal, and then if I present like that, that would be, you know, too fanatic. No, there is only devotional service. The gross materialist, he is worried about getting his money, his position, his power. What is money, position, and power? It's Krishna. So the guy is totally Krishna conscious. Right? But he doesn't know that that's what he's conscious of. He has no idea. Therefore, he's an illusion. There's no living entity on the planet that's not God conscious. So this idea that we make it separate like that, we only do that because we have this material perspective. That's why we present it, that there's a material world. But we see Prabhupada call it the so-called material world. In his vision, everybody from the spiritual world, there is no material world. It's just an inferior place, you know. You know, it's like the attic or the basement, you know. It's messy, it's dirty, it's not very well organized. You know. but it's part of the house. You know, but what we have is that somebody's taking the basement as a completely separate entity than the house. And it has no, and so if you talk about the house, then you have to be very careful because people will freak out. Like that. The point is that the Vedanta philosophy is the universal philosophy. And devotional service, that as that conclusion of that, that is the natural thing. Everybody's looking for it. But nowadays, everyone's talking about, you know, devotion, surrender, doing things for others, considering others, listening to others, speaking about what others are interested in, right? And then we're thinking, oh yeah, we got to do like that. But isn't that what preaching a devotional service means? Sacrifice means voluntarily giving up the results of one's endeavor for someone else. If we say that, oh, that's fanatic. But if we say, oh, you know, be nice, do things for other people, oh, yes, we have to do that. It's like, what's this? What's going on? You know what I'm saying? That's it. If we just change from Ananda Namoy to Pranamoy, use the same point, then it's okay. You know, but Ananda Namoy, you know. It's sad. And where it's coming from? Material attachment. Prestige. From that main thing I see, it comes from the communication department. Because they're so embarrassed to be known as devotees. They want to somehow or another, like that. They'll always go in karmikos of these programs, you know, the interfaith program. Everybody else is in their normal, you know. The nuns are dressed as nuns. The priests are dressed as priests. The rabbis are dressed as rabbis, you know. But we come in karmikos because, you know, we don't want to upset anyone, you know, like this. That's where I've seen is they preach the most about this. And somehow or another, you know, Harinam's bad, all these different things, all, you know. So, you know, it's like that. It gives bad impression. Right, what? To this slight little narrow middle-class people that they're worried about impressing. Everybody else doesn't really care. You know, basically the whole of Asia, Africa, Middle East, South America, Central America, you know, and probably you could throw in the Inuits up north, is they don't really care that people who are religious wear what they wear. You know? It's standard. So, the point is that one adjusts for time, place, and circumstance. That's not a problem. But the point is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, when he's having that, you know, at a table, a Western dinner being served with tea and everything like that to these British people, he's discussing Vedanta. He just created an environment that they're comfortable to listen to Vedanta. Right? But we focus more on the, you know, don't reduce that. No, bring up the other one. You know, devotees talk about, oh, you've divided that. Where is it? Where is that culture and class that people can come and really feel that there's something there? You know, that's the preaching. If you're going to use these Western things, then use them in their high-class way. Not on this kind of half-off-the-street, half-hearted kind of attempt. You know. Does that make sense? So the point is devotional service is all we discuss. We have a wide range of vocabulary so that we can discuss it at any level that someone can appreciate it. That's the whole point, is that if we know the philosophy enough, we can talk to everybody. But these are the cantos that show you how to do that. And these are the cantos that are not necessarily appreciated. You know, you want to talk to people on their level. This shows you how to do it. He just did right here. Like that. We constantly see the acharyas, they do this. They're able to present the transcendental from the material perspective, but in such a way that you actually progress in it and then you naturally adjust over into the transcendental. But the other ones, is you don't really want them to adjust. You don't have to change anything in the house. And then when the guy says, wow, you guys all wear dhotis, I like to wear a dhoti, you know, too. No, no, you don't have to do that. You know, it's like, what was that? How is that preaching? How is that transcendental? How is that not mundane? You know, we have all these anxieties that somehow or another devotional, you know, the material world's got its normal vision, and then alternative devotional service is not the you know, there's something else in the universe, and then there's us over in the corner. The whole cosmic creation thinks the way the Shastra does. Even the demons on the lower planets understand all this stuff.
I was preaching to one guy, and it didn't really work until I got him in a dhoti. And he was looking down and said, "This is great."
Yeah.
It's like wearing clothes and not wearing clothes at the same time.
Yeah. But it's just like that.
A couple of weeks later, he had a bead bag in his hand.
Yeah, you just have to know how to present. That's the thing, is we talk about political correctness, but we're probably the worst at it. You know, we're just so 1990-ish, you know. Political correctness means you can take anything and spin doctor it into something attractive. You know, the guys that they actually pay to do this, that's what they can do. Like that. It's that you can make anything. That's the nice thing about vocabulary. You make anything look good. Or you can also turn it and make anything look bad. That's the hope.
For example, called the devotees pajama people. Pajama?
Yeah, so we're the pajama people. So what? Yeah, and then when you go down to the, yeah, and then when they go down to the yoga studio, what are they wearing? They're pajama people. Hey, come on, we've been telling you this for the last, you know, 40 years, and now finally you figured it out. That's the whole point. If you're comfortable with it, people don't get bothered. I remember this one devotee was telling me, you know, it's New York, of course. So they're going into somebody's house to do a program. And, you know, there's always the guy sitting on the stoop, right? So as they're walking in, then the guy sitting on the stoop turns to one devotee and says, "Hey, what's with the bed sheets?" And then the devotee turns to him and said, "The blankets were all dirty." And the guy just laughs, and then, you know, hey, okay, these Hare Krishnas are great, you know? And then after the program that came out, you know, discussed with him a bit and this and that, and, you know, things are cool. But, you know, they think they wear bed sheets, oh, that's so bad. It doesn't matter what you wear. Guaranteed there's somebody thinking you look disgusting. Guaranteed, doesn't matter what you wear. And then we're going to change that, you know, so what does this mean? That just means insecurity. Point is, you look like a gentleman, dressed like a gentleman, say, well, devotees don't know how, why don't they learn? You know, why not have, you know, a seminar, how to put on a dhoti, how to wear a sari, you know? Yes.
I was in South India at a costume studio, and an Indian brought his son there. They were going to have some kind of ceremony or festival or something, and he was getting his son a dhoti that was already, you know, sewn together.
Right.
So he didn't have to, like, figure out how to put on the dhoti.
Yeah.
I mean, that was sad.
Interesting, someone was telling me that in Rome for 6 months, dhotis were in fashion amongst the karmis. But they were sewn like that. You bought them already ready, you just put them on. They were in fashion for 6 months. You know, it makes this more avant-garde and stuff like that. Your general thing is... Okay, also termed Atmarama Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma Labdho Pasanti. Okay, so these are all the terms. Atmarama Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma Labdho Pasanti is the goal of Bhakti Misra Yogi. Such transcendentalist aspires to taste the soul's joy at being released from the distress of material identification. They want that taste, rather than simply just pleasing Krishna and the taste from that, which is higher. They're specifically thinking this taste will be good. Therefore, it's there. It's something you can pass through if you want. But the point is, keep going. Otherwise, if you get stuck, then you only come back this way.
Yeah.
Like that. Srila Prabhupada writes in his purport to verse 17, "For the impersonalist, the ultimate goal or destination is the Brahma Jyotir of the spiritual sky. But for the devotees, the ultimate goal is the Vaikuntha planets. The devotees experience the above-mentioned state of affairs by attainment of spiritual forms for activity in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. But the impersonalist, because of his neglecting the association of the Lord, does not develop a spiritual body for spiritual activity, but remains a spiritual spark only, merged in the effulgent spiritual rays of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Right, so the devotee already gets that because Brahman is everywhere. So you're situated in Brahman, so you already have that. But the point is you have a spiritual body, you have a relationship with the Lord, you get much more.
So it means it's not automatic that you get the body there, it's only if you need it for the service?
Yes, it means unless you've developed a relation with the Lord, then you don't get a spiritual body. Like that. The impersonalists, because they only cultivate transcendence, they only are situated in transcendence. The devotee is, because he cultivates that relationship, he has a spiritual body situated in transcendence. Yes.
I've always had this question. Is a spiritual body developed over time, or is it just awarded? Like this is part of Bhagavatam where Narada describes how suddenly, it was like lightning or something, suddenly he had this transcendental
thing. What do you mean by awarded?
Meaning like you're awarded a material body according to material nature, according to your past karma, your past lives. So is a spiritual body developed over time? You know, we bury sadhus, you know, we have samadhis. They've spiritualized their body. Yudhisthira went to heaven in the same earth body. Is it something, a spiritual body, does it develop over time, or is it just awarded when you reach that stage?
So you're talking about before reaching the platform of liberation, is it being developed?
After liberation, someone's...
But I'm saying it's after liberation, then what do you start with? They just have a foot or something, they hop around. You know, because their devotion develops, then, you know, they get a hand, you know.
The jiva is described like a salt crystal, where it's 1/10,000th of the tip of the hair, but at some point, this form, it takes on a form.
Yes.
So, I don't know, but you've seen anything in Shastra that you could say that this, because we're going through, let's say somebody's at the higher stages and they've found their rati, they've found their service to Krishna, and they're...
But what do you mean by higher stages?
On the way to praying, where they're actually...
No, but are they liberated or they're not? Okay, Sarup City, Sarup means form.
Right. So
because the form's not the major thing, the attitude's the major thing.
Right.
Because the point is we see in the Bhagavatam, gopis mentioned who have the form. They're there in the spiritual world in the spiritual form, but they don't get to go to the rasa dance. Why not? Because they're quite comfortable on this transcendental platform being distracted by the transcendental energy. So they're happy doing their services in the house and making their cow dung patties and taking care of the, you know, children and the family and doing all the services. So they have to get rid of that. Getting rid of that, then they are able to go to the rasa dance. It's sahajiyas make this big thing out of the spiritual body. We make the big thing out of the spiritual attitude.
Because
For them it's not about attitude, that you fake. They talk about the spiritual form, that you get the sarup and that's the big thing. But for us it's like, that just goes normally. It just goes as part of the package. You know, you buy a bus ticket, you know, a bus comes along with it. You know, you don't have to separately, you know, okay, you got the ticket, now I have to pay for the bus, okay, like that, you know, now I have to pay for the wheels on the bus, you know. And he says, does that make sense? So in other words, the form is the natural form that's there, but then it's the attitude to work with it. Because it means you may, it appears that the form's first, then the attitude's second, but actually the attitude's first, the form is second. Because without the attitude, the form doesn't have any meaning. Does that make sense? Like I get the box and it has a machine in it, but until I've read the manual and understood everything, I can't use it. So the Shravana Dasa means hearing about the position of the living entity and Lord in that particular realm. What is the devotional attitude? So that's why we talk about Braja Bhakti, because that's the first stage, that's Shravana Dasa. Then being able to adjust with that and apply it into our situation to serve Krishna, that's Varna Dasa, that's the second stage. Like we do the same thing here. We hear about Krishna. We already have a form, but we don't know how to use it for Krishna. Then Varna Dasa, we adjust how to engage our conditioning in Krishna's service. Then comes Smarana Dasa. Then having been, that's the focus, then we become absorbed in Krishna until we come to Samadhi. Then coming to that platform of Samadhi, then the Rati is complete. It means complete in the way of that attraction, Purva Rag, that attraction to Krishna is complete. It's full. So, because before that it's been not in its full state. Because Rati is the power that drives the devotional process. So a neophyte devotee at Shraddha, it's still, Shraddha is just that much of Bhava Bhakti, Rati. But as it matures and it comes to Purva Rag, then you could say now one is nicely situated dynamically in Bhava Bhakti, because now one can directly associate with the Lord in his pastimes. Because before that, one's not. One's associating with associates, but not with the Lord. Right? Then, that in that association, then you pick up more detailed the attitude that they have. That then matures into praying. Understand? So the form is just what's the natural form according to that mood that one has. But one has to develop the mood of service to be able to use it. So the most important focus is I am a servant of Krishna. If you cultivate that, then the sarup will be able to be used. So that's why it says there, it's a flash. That you're just changing from one situation to the other. That's just a flash. So you have your spiritual form, but the point is what are you going to do with it? That's the whole point.
Alright, so when we reverse the situation, this is how we get the material body as well?
Yes, you develop the material attitude.
Right.
And then, naturally, the material body follows. So if you cultivate the spiritual attitude, the spiritual body follows. So attitude's always first. Because material, spiritual is vision, is attitude. It's not what body you have.
Right. Body just follows the mood.
Body follows the mood. That's given in Brahma Samhita, that Yam Kama Krodha Sahajata Miyadi Bhikkhu. Is that according to the devotional attitude of the devotee, then you get that spiritual form. Like that. So it's simultaneous. Like that. Mother Jashoda is in that form because of her attitude. The gopis are in that form because of attitude, the cowherd boys. Like that. So we're in the form that we're in now because of our attitude. So the particular body we have, the situation we're in, is because of our attitude. So that's the point, is that it doesn't matter to the soul, because the soul is natural position is the spiritual world. You cultivate that attitude, then you'll transfer yourself there. But the principle is the same, is that the soul is there, you have a form, you have activities, you have results, you have experience. Now you connect it to Krishna, you develop the spiritual. You don't connect to Krishna, you cultivate the material. The mechanics are the same, because it's just like the arm moves in the mirror the same as it does in real life. So the material mechanics are the same as in the spiritual world. But they're a reflection, so you don't get the full benefit. You know, it's like the cowherd boys and Krishna sitting around eating the things that Mother Jashoda sent out into the cowherd, you know, out of the pastures. They use their hand and pick it up and put it in their mouth. They do the same thing here. Just there, they actually get some serious taste that lasts eternally. Here, you know, that moment, as long as you're hungry, it's good. And then afterwards, it kind of disappears. Yes.
Now
that
here we have to worry just to
develop
the service attitude, or
service
attitude in special rasa?
No, because you see, it's generic. Braja Bhakti is a kind of bhakti. What rasa is expressed through, that's a detail. just like if you know cooking, then it can be expressed through a variety of preparations. Right? But because you sit down with a recipe and go through it and cook it, doesn't mean you're a cook. You understand? So the idea is you first develop that attitude of service that the residents of Vrindavan have. The detail of the form, that will come afterwards. Does that make sense? That comes first, because that's generic. All the residents of Vrindavan, it's pure unalloyed devotion. Right? All those in Vaikuntha, it's worship and majesty. Right? And awe and reverence. So that's the generic. Now, whether they're male or female, or whether they have a horse head or not, or these kind of things, that's all according to the detail of taste. Is that something? Yeah. Right? Right? In other words, if you're not hungry, then what's the point of talking about preparations? You know what I'm saying? It doesn't do anything. But when you're hungry, then you can get... there has some meaning in talking about different preparations. Does that make sense? Srila Prabhupada writes in his purport, "For the impersonalist, the ultimate goal or destination is the Brahma Jyoti of the spiritual sky, but for the devotees, the ultimate goal is the Vaikuntha planets. The devotees experience the above-mentioned state of affairs, means of liberation, by attainment of spiritual forms for activity." Right? They have no spiritual form, there's no activity, but the devotees, by attaining the spiritual form for activity, they experience the same thing, plus then whatever is there from the activity. Like that. In the transcendental loving service of the Lord. But the impersonalist, because of his neglecting the association of the Lord, does not develop a spiritual body for spiritual activity, but remains a spiritual spark only, merged in the effulgent spiritual rays of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Lord is the full-fledged form of eternity, bliss, and knowledge, but the formless Brahma Jyotir is simply eternity and knowledge. The Vaikuntha planets are also forms of eternity, bliss, and knowledge. And therefore the devotees of the Lord who are admitted into the abode of the Lord also get bodies of eternity, bliss, and knowledge. As such, there is no difference between one and another. The Lord's abode, name, fame, entourage, etc. are of the same transcendental quality. And how this transcendental quality differs from the material world is explained herewith in this verse. In the Bhagavad Gita, three principal subjects have been explained by Lord Krishna, namely Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga. But one can reach the Vaikuntha planets by the practice of Bhakti Yoga only. The other two are incompetent in helping one reach the Vaikuntha lokas, although they can, however, conveniently take one to the effulgent Brahma Jyotir as described above. Right. So, if you practice nice karma, you will get liberated. So the point is we practice it in connection with Krishna, then we go to the spiritual world. But if you practice it not connected to Krishna, you will get to the Brahma Jyoti. So that's why the path from where we are up to liberation is the same as what the impersonalists use. The difference is they're not cultivating the form of the Lord at the same time. Therefore, they come up to that point, stop, we keep going. So, yes.
Shukadeva Goswami here explains a very difficult process, not here, but before that. Marriage, with the prince there.
Yes.
Whatever you're supposed to do.
Yes. And very exact.
Sorry. But what does it have to do with us?
What does it have to do with us? Okay. Now, is your mind going to be absorbed in Krishna? At some point.
Yes.
Yes, okay. what, you're not talking now, are you?
Not too quick.
Okay.
So that's going to happen, no? And then using spiritual intelligence, you'll make discriminations how nice you to serve Krishna. Right? So what was the difference between that and what the yogi was doing? Which technical? Okay. The yogi wishes to voluntarily leave his body. He should sit comfortably. Do you have a problem with comfortable? No. following the process. Okay, through meditation. Okay, so do we not think of the Lord? Absorb ourselves in thinking of the Lord? Yes, but I'm saying, are we not doing that as a process? Okay, so that's the connection with the Lord. We do it through bhakti yoga. They're doing it through ashtanga yoga. Or through dhyana yoga. Right? Or karma yoga. So we're using bhakti yoga. So the yoga means connecting with the Lord. So the process is the same. It's just what medium you want to use. Okay. Does that make sense? Just like cooking. The process of cooking is the same. The principles of cooking. Now, depending on what medium you use, it comes out as a different cuisine. Does that make sense? So that's all. So that's why if I'm discussing one cuisine, someone who's an actual cook can apply it into anything else. Like I'm showing, let's say, how to refry beans. You could also refry, you know, cauliflowers. You know what I'm saying? You know, in Indian cooking. Does that make sense? I boiled the beans and then I'm frying them. I steamed the cauliflower and now I'm frying it. You know what I'm saying? You could take anything and put it anywhere, because the process is the same. I boil a potato, I can boil anything else also. Does that make sense? I can fry one thing, I can fry something else. Does that make sense? So that's the point is the yoga process is the same. Now the medium is expressed through. That's what makes it karma yoga, jnana yoga, dhyana yoga. Does that make sense? Like that. But using all these elements, connecting to the Lord through devotion, that's called bhakti yoga. So the items of karma, jnana, and dhyana are natural elements of bhakti yoga. Right? But we're not used to them as bhakti yoga. We're used to them as these other three. Because these other three we've been doing since time immemorial. We've done karma, we've done jnana, we've done yoga. You know, we've gotten sick of that, you know, become Buddhist, got sick of that, then back to the karma again. You know, we just keep going around. Is that? But, so that's why it'll be described at all these levels. So you have to describe it at a level that's going to catch everybody's attention. Right? So for the karmi, you need the mode of goodness. The jnani, you need the mode of goodness. The yogi, you need the mode of goodness. So mode of goodness is the common ground that all these yogis will be. There. For us, goodness is not so much a thing as pure goodness, but it's not even the element of pure goodness, it's the element of pure goodness that's pleasing Krishna. Because like, goodness is performing your duties, right? Without a desire for the result. That means the immediate. But pure goodness is even in long term, you're not looking for the result for yourself. It's just for pleasing Krishna. So we're not looking at the motive. Pure goodness aspect of it, we're looking at the devotional aspect of it. Understand? But that pure state, that's called Vasudev Sattva. That's the platform these karmis, jnanis, and yogis are trying to get to. So if you use that terminology, then they're all inspired. Does that make sense? The difficulty comes is that we always tend to connect the externals and the activities as separate from the results. You know, we put more emphasis there on the situations, on the endeavor. Because in the material world, results aren't really anything substantial. They keep moving. You get them, then they move. But they don't stay as a goal. That's the thing, is a devotional platform, then it's always remains, because it's an eternal process. Does that make sense? Yeah. Is that okay?
Yeah.
So these terms will be used because if we can adjust with these and these platforms and give up the attachment on these levels, then when we get to 10th canto, we don't have to discuss these at all because we'll automatically be situated on the transcendental platform. Otherwise, we'll get to, you know, the 10th canto, Mother Jashoda gets into mudras and all that, and nyasas for Krishna to purify after, you know, that incident with the Trinavarta demon or Shatakasura. And so then we get distracted by rituals and all these kind of things as Mother Jashoda does. So you want to avoid that. So that's why the first 9 cantos are there. So when we get to the 10th, we'll appreciate it as the Brajbasis appreciate it. Yes.
I suggest before that for people who are pessimistic, the indirect process is recommended, or is that?
But pessimistic, what does pessimistic mean?
I was wondering.
Pessimistic, well, Bisa means that, you know, nothing's going to go right and all that. But why would that bother them? If there's a pure pessimist, nothing's going to go right. Why should they think about nothing going right? Because it's not going to go right anyway. Why do you have to worry about that? You know what I'm saying? So what does it mean? A pessimist is actually a person who really wants it to go properly, but it hasn't up to now. And so all it is there. It's just an emotional reaction to not getting what they think it should be. You know what I'm saying? That's all. They've just lost faith that it can, but it's not that they don't want it. So a pessimist is no different than anybody else. It's just that there's more of an emotional trip to get to what they want. Does that make sense? Yes.
So is that then a good idea to use the indirect to deal with this emotional?
Yeah, it means the indirect takes away material emotion because you break everything down and then it's connected to the Lord, so it doesn't leave any room really for a material emotion. But you're dealing in the areas of your attraction by material emotion. That's why it works.
So you can transform it from material to spiritual.
Yes, that's the thing, is that so it's used when it's necessary. It's not necessarily that we'll use it in the exact same, detail. Mechanics are the same. We connect everything that is we find important to Krishna. So then they're connecting whatever that they perceive here to Krishna. But in the past, all those things have been illusion to them. And us, it's not illusion, it's illusory. It's real, but we have an illusion over it, but they think it doesn't exist. Right? So they have to change their concept of illusion. Right? So that means they have to change their concept of the Lord. Because if everything's Brahman, that means nothing actually can be illusion. But they're saying everything's illusion, that's why they're Mayavadi. Right? Everything's illusion. Does that make sense? So they have to change that. Yes.
How does this transformation of material into spiritual emotions work, like practically?
Practically, it's just understanding that that's where it should be applied, and then just applying the emotions into that forum as opposed to another.
Can you put it in a more detailed, practical way? Like, say, say I'm angry at somebody, and then...
But why are you angry? I mean, if we want to get into detail and practical here, then, you know what I'm saying? In other words, you're going to talk generic, then you're angry at somebody because they didn't do something that you expected that they would do if they were you. Right? But they're not you. They didn't do it. Right? But then who is this you? Who is the you?
Well, that's pretty much your identity.
Yes, but that you that you identify with, what is that you? Is it the soul you, or is it the conditioning you? You understand? Because for the soul, what did the other soul not do? Right? That would bother the soul, since the soul's not disturbed by anything, you know, within the material world. Then it's because you identify with the material conditioning. They have acted in a way that's different from your conditioning. And the point is no one in the world should act differently. At the same time, we should be unique, right? That's a side quest. Right?
Go there.
Yeah. And so then that principle is we project that everybody should act in this way, and if they don't, then I become unhappy. But what's the basis of it? The basis is a self-centered concept, a misidentification of who we are, and therefore how everybody should deal with who we think we are. So what's to get upset about? That's this process. The other is that we apply, you want to get angry about what somebody does, get angry about how people don't deal properly with devotees or stuff like that. So it can be engaged. You know. Does that make sense? Yes.
I ran into something a few years ago that I tried to sort out with the devotee. He's a younger, kind of younger guy. A little frivolous, and he made a statement that I philosophically I had a problem with, but I was trying this, you know, this thing you said, illusory and not illusory. But his statement was, this material world is like a dream. So I had an issue with that. It didn't. You know,
it is like a dream, but dreams are real. It means there is such a thing called a dream. What it consists of is not necessarily the reality of how things are. You know, just like, is a toy shop real? Does it exist? Right? Yes. But what is presenting, is it real? It's a dream. So the point is dreams are real. Not that what they're presenting is real, but they exist. Dreams exist. This idea when the Mayavadis say the world's a dream, then they're trying to say is it doesn't exist, but it exists. Dreams exist. So the point is, and what's a dream made of? It will always be made of something within your experience. The Prabhupada says, you see gold, you see a mountain, then you see a golden mountain. Or you see a golden mountain and a bird, and then you see a flying golden mountain. You know? So, but they're made up of elements that actually you've seen. The illusion is what you think it is, that it's for my enjoyment. The reality is that it's the Lord's potency. That's what's real.
And the way he was using it, I felt like he had this tendency to not take responsibility.
Yeah, but the point is okay, if it's just a dream, and it's not real, then why would you as the soul be trying to enjoy the dream? Right? The point is if it's a dream, that means you're something else than the dream. So why aren't you engaged in the activities of the real self? Why are you happy to be involved in the dream? Yeah. So you just catch them at that point. You always try to get down to what's the basic fundamentals that they're working with. But in doing that, you have to find the exact language and mood that they can appreciate. Because most people don't like truth. They talk about it, but they actually just don't want it. Right? They really don't want it. Thus, Labdho Prashanti is never to be consumed with rasa graha, in which the devotee's joy is smaram amukunda angri, constant remembrance of the sweetness, rasa, of the Lord's lotus feet, even though that devotee may apparently be fallen from the liberated position. My dear Vyas, even though a devotee of Lord Krishna sometimes falls down, somehow or other, he certainly does not undergo material existence like others, fruit of workers, etc. Because a person who has once relished the taste of the lotus feet of the Lord can do nothing but remember that ecstasy again and again. Srimad Bhagavatam 1.5.19. Right, so this is the difference, is even though they're situated in the same place, the taste is different. For the devotee, it's rasa graha. For the impersonalist, it's labdo pashanti. Right? They want the taste, like they're talking about Brahmananda.
Yeah.
The devotee's not worried about Brahmananda. He's worried about rasa. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, let us say you have a whole bunch of people, right? Packed, you know, 100,000 people, stadium, right? You know, it's the biggest game of the year, the final, you know, match, the final move, the final seconds, you know, and then something amazing happens. Everybody's standing up in the stadium and they're all absorbed in what's happening there in the sport. And one guy's going, wow, this is such a great stadium. Wow, isn't this, how big is this stadium? That's so many people. Right? You understand?
Yeah.
That's the difference between the one and the other. The devotee is absorbed in what is there to be gained in interaction, the relationship. While the other is just simply worried about the situation. And that's the point. That's why it said we have to be free from impersonalism, because we basically worry about situations. If I have the right situation, I'll be happy.
Yes. Can we say that impersonalists, they do look for the taste and they don't get it, and devotees, they don't look for the taste and they get it and they reach there?
You could say on that level, but at the same time, as there is a taste in the transcendental situation. But the point is because the soul is Satchit and Ananda. And this Brahman, is, as Prabhupada pointed out, is sat, and then the chit means there's knowledge, but it's not applied in activity. So it's technically only half of chit. Right? So because it doesn't have the other half, activity, then there's no ananda. Right? You have to have activity to get ananda. So then it's just the happiness of neutrality, of being no problem. But it's just like, if I get rid of a big problem, then do we spend the rest of our life happy that we've gotten rid of that problem? Or do we spend our life trying to do something positive to create other experiences? So that's the point, is how long can one sit in that neutral state? That's why the yogi falls back into the material world from the Brahmajyoti. Does that make sense? So it's just that they'll taste something, but what they're tasting is so minimal. It's just like there. How long can you go on talking about how big the stadium is? At some point, now what do you do with the stadium? You know what I'm saying? So that's the whole thing. So there's no activity. So therefore, there's no personal activity and interaction. Therefore, there's no long-term result. And it's very meager. Yeah, there's something. Brahmananda is just, that's the platform you function at. It means you just exist in that. But now the activity is beyond that. Like you're in your house. Okay, you're in your house. So there may be that feeling of that moment of security or, you know, comfort or like that. And then how long do you stay like that? The whole rest of the day? Or it's like after thinking that, then you, you know, walk into the kitchen to check out what's in the refrigerator. Right? That's the whole point. That's the difference. Is the one has a level of satisfaction, but that's where it ends. While the other one then continues beyond that. So that's why the point is always made about the happiness of Brahmananda is like a fraction of a portion of a drop of an unlimited ocean. You know, we're not saying it's not there and it's not real, we're just saying it's very small compared to the other one.
Get it.
I just was thinking of what Tonto mentioned to the Lone Ranger. What do you mean, we, white man? You know what I'm saying? We're sitting here in the material world, and we're looking at why don't they get it, but we're the ones that don't get it. The impersonalists, they don't get it because they don't want to get it. The basic point is the living entity gets it when he wants to. He doesn't get it when he doesn't want to. That's the whole point. So that's why all this discussion is there, to convince us that this what's beyond, that's what we want. Otherwise, we're looking at, if we just take the material, means, in other words, what are we doing? Karma, right? Means the right, means, or the, what's the verse? Gives three: attachment, fear, and anger. Raga, bhaya, krodha, right? So in raga, material attachment, we're trying to get rid of material pains, right? We don't have a house, and that's a pain. We get a house. Okay, that pain's gone. Now the house, we need to adjust like this to get rid of those particular pains, and it just keeps on going eternally, right? So they're eternally trying to get rid of pain. When that getting rid of pain in that fashion doesn't work, then they think, why get rid of detail of pain? We'll get rid of all the pain, right? The whole material existence, by merging into the Brahman. Right? So that liberation. But we're taking it, the Brahman is substance. Right? And the material world's not substance. So when we get rid of the non-substance and are situated in substance, that getting rid of that pain, then we'll be happy. Then doing that for, thousands of lifetimes, we're not happy with that, then we become angry. Right? Because karma and jnana, which are the only options, don't work. Then we become angry, then it's voidism. It's just, there's nothing. Right? Yeah, the Buddhists are angry. That comes from anger. That's why they so easily get into this Shaivan Devi Tantra, because the mode of ignorance and anger and fighting and controlling, and it's like that. They control the energies and do these different things like that. It's quite heavy. Right? The tamasic element's very strong. So then that goes, and then there's nothing. And then there's nothing, really nothing. And then you just go, wow, you got to do something. So then again, you go back into. That's why it says these impersonal paths give rise to sense gratification. Because when you end it with nothing, you got to do something. And so then immediately they get into sense gratification. So you always see, is generally with any of these kind of things, there's a connection of sense gratification. At least in the ones that are popular.
Can we take it a little further and say that those who actually leave Krishna consciousness to indulge in sense gratification means they didn't get into something?
They didn't get into it enough, as pointed out here by this verse, that even a devotee somehow or another falls down. They still can't quite get into everything, because they already know that you can't get anything from it. Why did they become a devotee in the first place? There was no taste. So it's not that by going back, and let's say you have some sugar cane that's already been squozed, okay? And then, so you're chewing on it. There's no taste. So you give that up, right? And then you turn to Krishna consciousness. Then, being distracted by some way or another in Krishna consciousness, you go back to chewing that same sugar cane. Right, all you do is this time is turn it around. Oh, that side looks new. And then, are you now going to get a taste? No. And now you even know more that you can't, so it'll never work. That's why devotees, once they've taken up the process, they're not ordinary. There's no such thing. Even the devotees who aren't seemingly practicing that, they're not ordinary. They're unique. Yes.
Mayavad bouncing between nirvishesh and sense gratification is due to their offense to the Lord's feet and refusal to serve.
That's there, but even if you're just on the pure Brahmananda platform, it's that you don't know that the lotus feet are there, because there's no interest. The Mayavadis are offensive, the Brahmavadis aren't offensive, they just haven't thought beyond liberation. So they just know the material world's a problem, they want to get out, that's all. So they don't think so. Most of the Vedic philosophies, the actual, then are based on this impersonalism. Mayavadi is actually an introduction of Buddhism, with a Vedic Shastric basis. It's not actually a Vedic philosophy. It uses connections with Vedic philosophies to establish itself, but Buddhism is not part of it.
the Vedic concept.
In Prema Bhakti, right, so does that make the difference here? Because you were asking before about what does this have to do with us. It's the same thing, it's just the wording's used. So it will work for everything. So being the universal, this is the way you discuss it. You know what I'm saying? This is the fun part, is that these things are being discussed, and we have terms, we have words, we have all these things to use that can be used in a situation that you want to be more universal. But we don't catch that this is the universal preaching. And then we come up with something, you know, new, you know, as the universal preaching.
Yes.
What to do.
Yeah. Keep on with the Bhagavatam.
Yes, no. That's the option.
Yes.
In Prema Bhakti, the soul's eternal personal identity is termed Swarupa Labdha. Swarupo palabdhi, right, as opposed to labdo pashanti, as Srila Prabhupada explains in his purport to Bhagavatam 4.23.18. The real identity of the individual soul lies in understanding or attaining the knowledge that he's eternally a servant of Krishna. Right, that's the essence. That's what we were talking about before. You have to start there. I'm servant. That's the first point. I'm the soul. I'm not the body, I'm the soul. The soul is I'm servant of Krishna. That's the natural position. Then within that, is it in sweetness or in opulence? Right? Then once those realms are chosen, then there's details within that. Right? This understanding is called Swarupo Palabdhi. By culturing devotional service, the devotee gradually comes to understand his actual relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Right? So he cultivates, he actually understands this real relationship. Mm-hmm. So this is, in answering what you were saying before, is the cultivation within the sadhana, it's a gradual process to appreciate or understand or for that to be revealed. But the actual gaining of it is just in the moment. Does that make sense? Like that, when you transfer from here to there, you will have a complete body with all limbs and everything like that. You don't have to worry. You only have part of it and having to wait for like that. You know, you're there, yeah, there's no arm. And why no arms? It says, oh, I must have committed some offense to Prashad. So he meditated and offered prayers to Prashad, and then your right arm appears. You don't have to worry like that. Huh?
Be easier and
comfortable. Yes.
You know what
you meditate. Long list of
things. Like that. No feet. Oh, I didn't go to the temple. You're just sitting there and smiling. What's wrong with him? Oh, he has no brain. How come? He never got into studying Gita. Yeah, it'll work out.
Keep coming to classes.
Yeah. So that'll happen immediately, but gradually you can see is that it's happening, because the process of bhava bhakti, the first three stages, are beginning before you actually take up devotional service. When you associate with devotees, hear about the glories of the Lord, are engaged in devotional service, the taste or interest or attraction you're gaining at that point, that's actually just very, small amount of bhava bhakti. That's what's happening. Then that matures as the sadhaka, then one comes to actually be situated fully in bhava bhakti. Then by being situated properly in that, in the association of the eternal associates, then one develops prema. Does that make sense? So you do have the element of the gradual and of the immediate. Both are there. Like that.
Yeah.
And if you can do them both at once,
better.
Both. Like that. This understanding of one's pure spiritual position is called Swarupo Palabdhi. And when one attains that stage, he can understand how he is related with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as a servant or friend or as a parent or conjugal lover. See, Prabhupada mentions it twice here. So the first is developing the devotional service. I am eternal servant of Krishna. This understanding is called Surupa Upalabdhi. Yeah. By culturing devotional service, the devotee gradually comes to understand his actual relationship. Mm. So, it's already started as I'm servant of the Lord.
Yeah.
Right? So this personal, one's eternal personal identity is already started with that. That's the difficulty when some say, no, you have to cultivate by reading about certain pastimes and things like that. That's a weakness. Because no, it's not that. It's about the attitude of devotional service and the attitude of pure devotional service. That's what's Brajabhakti. It's not about reading about this. That's a detail. That will help cultivate, but that's not actually the process at this point. We have to start with this one. Then naturally the other one will start to develop, right?
Yes.
But it's not that by reading about the gopis, then one will develop that. No, it's about reading about the love that the gopis and the residents of Braja have, that kind of prema, that one will be interested. It's not the pastimes, that's an expression of it. You understand? Because we have that process, but we use that on this side. I don't want to do anything. I'd rather sit on the couch all day, but I'm washing pots for Krishna. Right? We start with that. But that's that in the spiritual world, we don't generally use that. So it becomes, yes.
So when we start to practice pure devotional service, this is when our spiritual body starts to develop.
Yes, you could say. Means our knowing of it. Means we already have a spiritual form. It's just that it gets left. It's, I think Jiva Goswami mentions that when you come into the material world, it's kind of like you have a coat room and you leave your spiritual body there. You know? You know, the problem is we've lost the ticket. Ticket, please. It's kind of a nice spiritual, you know, Satchitananda. Yes.
So by this process, we can at least describe it. So.
Yeah.
Where did he say that?
It's in the Sandarbhas. Somewhere in the Sandarbhas. Yes, it's in the Sandarbhas. It might also include Krama, but that I know of, it's, you know, like that. Okay, then he says, by culture and devotion, gradually comes to understand his actual relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Means, so he's already understood his identity as servant, but then the actual relationship. So there's identity and relationship. These two aren't separated. So they take it that they're one thing. Technically, it means you apply it as one thing, but you develop the identity, then the relationship. Right? This understanding of one's pure spiritual position is called Surupa Upalabdhi. And when one attains that stage, he can understand how he is related with the Supreme Personality of Godhead as a servant friend. Then he can understand that. So it's not a matter of cultivating that separately. You're cultivating Surupa Upalabdhi, which means culturing I'm servant of Krishna and devotional service. Then the other will happen automatically.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. Right, we're associating through the Bhagavatam with the Brajabhasis and the Chaitanya Charitamrita with the Brajabhasis. So it's natural we're going to develop that attitude. Right? So we don't have to worry about that. We just have to worry about developing this beginning position. That's the foundation. Because if you don't have the foundation, how does anything build on that?
Om Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Srila Prabhupada ki
Jai
Sarvaveta Bhaktivrinda ki
Jai
Jainatai Gaura Prema.